Well, last time I was saying that as long as a messenger RNA transcript still exists, it will still be translated, right? And if you want to turn that off, you destroy the mRNA transcript eventually. Well, in 19, we see that not only can an mRNA transcript be used again after translation takes place, but actually the same mRNA transcript can be simultaneously translated by multiple different ribosomes at different positions on the same transcript. In other words, an mRNA does not have to wait until translation ends before translation begins again with that same transcript. Because as soon as the ribosomal subunits move out of the way enough to make room for another ribosomal subunit to come along, that will happen. And what we have here in lavender are exact copies of the same polypeptide being produced, but in different stages of production. Because this one on the left just got started. This one started a little earlier, so it's longer, and so on. And this whole arrangement of one mRNA transcript and however many ribosomes are simultaneously attached and translating that mRNA is called a polyribosome. So this allows for a cell to get a bunch of copies produced in a lot less time than it would take if it had to wait. And keep in mind also that there's nothing saying that a cell makes only one transcript. Right? You can transcribe the same gene multiple times to make many copies of mRNA, and each copy of mRNA can be multiply translated, so you can ramp up production of a lot of copies of the same polypeptide in pretty short order. That brings us to 20. Now, translation itself as a process produces a polypeptide, right? That's the final product of translation. But the final product of translation, the polypeptide itself, might or might not be ready to go to do its job, whatever that job of that particular kind of protein is. In other words, some polypeptides don't need to be further processed after they're created by translation. Others do need to be processed before they can do their job. And since that occurs, since that occurs after translation, we call that post-translational modification. Earlier we talked about post-transcriptional modification. That's modification of the pre-mRNA, right? Here we're talking about post-translational modification of the polypeptide that's created in translation. And somewhere along the line when we were talking about ribosomes, I forget which chapter it was, I think probably the tour of the cell chapter, I said that we have two different names for ribosomes, even though really they're not different ribosomes. We can call ribosomes either free ribosomes or bound ribosomes. A free ribosome is simply a ribosome that's not attached to a membrane. It's just in the cytosol by itself. A bound ribosome is a ribosome that is attached to the membrane that makes up the endoplasmic reticulum. And which part of the endoplasmic reticulum am I talking about?
Rough ER.
Right, the rough ER, because the roughness of its appearance under a microscope, and the reason it was named that, is the ribosomes themselves. The rough ER features a bunch of ribosomes that are attached to that membrane. Just temporarily, though. And so my point here is that even though we have the terms free ribosome and bound ribosome, they are just different names for the same ribosomes in different times. Keep in mind also that a ribosome is really in two pieces until the time it starts working for translation. So the ribosomal subunits don't come together, remember, until an mRNA first binds to the small ribosomal subunit in initiation of translation, like we talked about last time. Well, that happens, that initiation of translation, when the ribosomal subunits come together with the mRNA, that happens always on free ribosomes. So translation always starts on a free ribosome in the cytosol, not associated with a membrane. Some polypeptides that are being built are not going to need to be modified after translation is complete. So not only do those polypeptides start being created on free ribosomes, but they go through the whole process on free ribosomes, and they'll just be released from the ribosome after translation into the cytosol where they were created, and they will fold up into their proper shape because of their sequence of amino acids, and they'll do their job. They don't need to be modified. But a lot of polypeptides do need to be modified, so they start on free ribosomes being translated. That's where the first amino acids are attached and start emerging from the translation complex. But then they're going to need modification. And keep in mind what the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is. The job of the rough ER is to modify newly made polypeptides. So, if a polypeptide that's being created by translation is one of these that needs to be modified after it's built, then the cell needs to know early on in the translation process that this is going to be one of those proteins, one of these polypeptides, and therefore the whole translation complex, the mRNA, the peptide that's being built, it's not a complete polypeptide yet, and the two ribosomal subunits, that whole complex needs to be translocated or moved from the cytosol to the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, because that ER is going to be responsible for doing the modification. And the question then is, how does the cell know whether a polypeptide is going to be one of these that require modification or not? Well, that has to do with the actual amino acids that are first added as the first several amino acids in an emerging polypeptide. You can see these green few that are on this polypeptide that's being built on a free ribosome out in the cytosol. That particular sequence of amino acids serves as a signal to tell the cell, I'm going to be one of these that need to be modified. All right. So that signal peptide, which is really just part of the polypeptide being built, is able to, because of its particular shape and sequence, fit into a different protein. Remember, the polypeptide is one protein that's being built. But it's going to interact with a different protein out in the cytosol that's already there. And that one, see, notice, is called a signal recognition particle, SRP. When the signal recognition particle binds to the signal peptide that's part of the polypeptide being built, that, of course, is another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? And when ligands bind to proteins, there's a shape change, and that shape change causes something to happen. In this case, it causes this whole translation complex, both subunits, the emerging polypeptide, the signal recognition particle itself, plus the mRNA, to move to the membrane of the rough ER, shown in blue here, and dock to it, connect to yet another protein, which is embedded in the membrane of the ER, the pinkish one right here, which is a complex of proteins, kind of like the nuclear pores are complex of proteins that have a hollow center. In other words, it forms a little pore. And that's called the translocation complex. There's many, many of them. You see that's perforated. Well, the translocation complex is proteins, and part of those, the surface of those proteins, recognizes the signal recognition particle that already recognized the emerging polypeptide. And that's what allows the docking. Okay, so the SRP binds temporarily to the translocation complex, which is a hole in the membrane, and it lines things up perfectly so that the polypeptide being built will be strung right through the lumen, or the hollow part of this tunnel-like translocation complex, so that as it continues being translated and gets longer and longer, the polypeptide will get put into the hollow interior, or the lumen, of the rough ER, which is exactly where it needs to be for that organelle, the rough ER, to do its job of modifying that polypeptide once it's built. Does that all make sense? You can see that happening right here. So this protein, whatever it is, this polypeptide, needs to be somehow modified, and how the modification, what the modification is, also depends on the protein. But that's the job of the ER to figure that out, and it's now in the right place for it to be modified. So it will do its job, package it in a vesicle like we already talked about, send it to the Golgi complex, and put it eventually in its correct place, whether it's in the cell or out of the cell. The ones that don't need help won't do this because they don't have to. They'll just go right to work out in the cytosol. Okay, 21. We need to talk a little bit about mutation, and we'll have more to say about mutation in other chapters, but this will be a first look at mutation as far as this upcoming test is concerned, which is, I guess, Tuesday, right? We actually have looked at this example before for a different reason in a different chapter. This is a mutation that leads to sickle cell disease in humans. So, first of all, hemoglobin is a multimeric protein. Its job is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood. So each red blood cell is packed with millions of copies of hemoglobin. But a single hemoglobin particle is a multimeric protein, which means it's made up of at least two polypeptides, right? In the case of hemoglobin, it's four polypeptides, but it's two copies of one type and two copies of another type. So it requires two different genes to specify how to build up one hemoglobin, right? Because each of the two different kinds of polypeptides requires its own protein coding gene. Well, for this example, we're paying attention to just one of these two genes, because it's one of these two genes that's affected by the mutation that leads to sickle cell disease. Anyway, the phrase wild type, which is used in genetics often, refers to the version of DNA that is seen in the greatest number of individuals in a population. So it's what you're most likely to encounter if you examined all the individuals, right? It's not to say that wild type has not been mutated. Of course, mutations is the reason that there's different versions of DNA to begin with compared to the original DNA in the first successful cells. So even what we call wild type has been mutated compared to something else. But when we use the word wild type and the word mutant, it's a comparison. Wild type is what most individuals have, and a mutant version is a change from that. But a mutation of any kind is simply some change in DNA sequence. Some change to the DNA. For whatever reason, it can be caused by mutagens, which is a word that refers to things that can cause mutation. And those can be chemicals. They could be radiation, like sunlight. It could be just simply that the cell makes a mistake when it's copying DNA. For whatever reason, if there's a change to what the DNA was in the previous cell, the cell that gave rise to the current cell, then we classify that as a mutation. And mutations can be wide-ranging or very localized. Here we'll talk about the wide-ranging ones later. These are very localized mutations, meaning they affect either one single nucleotide or just a very small number of nucleotides within a gene. Now, remember I said that your genes are just subsequences of DNA on a chromosome, and then there are sequences between the genes that don't code for proteins, and those sequences between the genes is actually most of your DNA, the vast majority, 99% of your DNA, or 98, something like that. And so if a mutation occurs, it's just random, it's accidental, and therefore it's most likely to affect some sequence between genes. And those wouldn't affect how the gene works necessarily, or it wouldn't affect what the gene codes for. But they're random, so every once in a while a mutation will occur within a gene, and the sequence within the gene will be affected, in other words. That's what we're looking at here. Well, these very small-scale mutations that affect just one nucleotide are called point mutations. And like I said, for hemoglobin, it requires two different genes. We're only looking at one gene, plus we're only paying attention here to one codon of the gene. It's not even nearly all of the gene. Remember, codon is best used to describe messenger RNA, but we can use codon to describe the corresponding part of the gene as well. We're looking at DNA here, so this is the gene. This triplet here you can consider to be a codon because it codes for the real codon that's in the mRNA. Anyway, it's double-stranded DNA, but remember in transcription only one of the strands is used. And the one that's used is the top one in this example. This is the template strand. CTT is just one triplet of many in the gene. The other ones we're ignoring because even in a person that has the mutation, all the other triplets are correct. They're just like the wild type. So the only thing that is affected is this one triplet, and even only one nucleotide in that triplet. Anyway, the triplet here in this position is supposed to be CTT for the wild type. And when that gets transcribed, of course, that produces in the mRNA a complementary triplet, which is GAA. Okay? This is in the mRNA. And then when translation occurs, GAA in the genetic code specifies one amino acid, which happens to be glutamic acid. That's what GLU stands for. All these other amino acids are different, but they're all part of this polypeptide that's part of hemoglobin in the wild type. Glutamic acid in this position, though, is the wild type condition. That leads to normal hemoglobin that has a normal functioning to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. Now, let's look at the point mutation that occurred on the right, leading to mutant hemoglobin. It's just barely mutant, though. But the point here is that just a single nucleotide matters sometimes. So it's supposed to be CTT, notice. Well, for whatever reason, that T is now an A. And CAT, you know, the DNA, once it's mutated, doesn't know it's mutated. It's simply a code. And the cell doesn't know the DNA is mutated, so when it comes time to transcribe that gene, it's going to be transcribed normally, meaning it's going to look at CAT, think that's correct. In fact, it is correct. It's just different. And it's going to produce an MRA that has in that position a codon GUA instead of GAA, because GUA is the complement of CAT. Well, when you look up GUA, it doesn't specify glutamic acid. It specifies valine instead. Every one of the other amino acids in the polypeptide, though, plus the entire other polypeptide, is completely normal. And that one amino acid being different makes all the difference. That's what leads to the cells being sickle-shaped and the hemoglobin being misshapen, being unable to carry oxygen as well, and leading to the symptoms of the disease, which leads to an early death. So this is really a good lesson in how important shape is. Shape means everything to a protein, whatever its job is, and shape is determined by the specific sequence of amino acids. That determines how it folds up, how those R groups interact with each other. Well, if you have even one of those different in a sequence of amino acids, then it's going to have a different shape and therefore work differently. By the way, sometimes random mutations lead to an even better version of a protein doing a better job than the wild type does, and this is exactly the ones that get favored by natural selection. This is how evolution works. This is how species get more and more adapted to their surroundings over time, because favorable mutations get selected for. Okay, so 22. Here we're looking at a few different categories of mutations. Almost all of these are also point mutations involving just one nucleotide, or sometimes we'll say one base pair, because one position, one nucleotide position is actually two nucleotides, one for each of the two strands in the DNA. That's where a base pair is. But anyway, you have wild-type DNA at the top as a reference. Each one of these different mutations below it differs from it somehow, but how the mutations happen get classified using different names. On the left column, these are all base pair substitutions. There's different ways to have, there's different effects of base pair substitutions. But a base pair substitution is just what the phrase says. One base pair in the wild type, whatever it is, which is a single nucleotide on one strand and the same position on the other strand, gets substituted for something else, by something else. So the example here at the top, well, before I get to the particular examples, if you have a substitution, that means that the overall length of the sequence, the overall number of nucleotides, does not change because something's being removed and then something's substituting in its place. Okay, so it doesn't get shorter or longer. It's the same length. It just isn't exactly the same sequence anymore. And that's important for a reason I'll get into in a minute, but let's look at the effects here. First example is classified as a silent mutation. Silent here doesn't have anything to do with making sound. It just means that, yes, it's a mutation, but it actually ends up having no effect at all on the trait of the individual. In other words, exactly the correct or wild-type protein is made anyway. And the reason this happens is because of something we've already talked about about the genetic code, which is that it's redundant, right? Remember, genetic code is redundant simply because we have more codons available to work with than we need to specify all 20 amino acids. 64 is greater than 20, in other words. Well, let's look at what's happening. In the wild type, in this position, which is where the mutation is occurring, that was supposed to be A on one and G. Where is it? Oh, G. GC. This is the part that was the wild type. Okay? Instead, you have AT. as the base pair. But in terms of one strand, it's this A that's really wrong instead of G. All right? It's a point mutation. Well, when you... That means that instead of having CCG... Am I on the right one? Yeah, CCG up here. Or no, it's the bottom one that's being used. I'm sorry. Instead of having GGC, you have GGT as the triplet, since this T is the one that's been changed. Well, when you look up GGT in the genetic code, it specifies glycine, which is the same amino acid that GGC, the normal version of the triplet, also specifies, and that's because of redundancy. So even though the DNA has been changed here by mutation, when you produce the mRNA, which is also different from the wild type, it still produces exactly the right polypeptide because it puts glycine in this position anyway. GGU specifies glycine just like GGC does. You see that? So the DNA and the RNA are different, but the protein ends up being identical. And therefore, that will not affect the trait at all. It's just a different way of getting to that polypeptide. A base pair substitution could also lead to what's called missense, though. In this case, it's this position. So you end up with AGC in that position instead of, where is it?
Are they not using that top one?
Oh, yeah, they are. AGC instead of GGC, right? Well, that's going to be transcribed into AGC, which specifies serine, different from phenylalanine, different from glycine. And so that's exactly what happened in the previous example of sickle cell. One amino acid is wrong, the rest of them are correct. But that one amino acid can make a difference. Now, in some cases, it doesn't really make much of a difference. So the effect does not have to be profound. But this is called missense anyway, because it's like getting one word wrong in a sentence. Okay? Missense. The bottom example, though, is called nonsense. And nonsense is getting much more confused than missense, right? The same thing is happening here. It's a one position that's being mutated. But instead of turning one amino acid specifying codon into a different amino acid specifying codon, what the mutation does is turn one amino acid specifying codon into one of the stop codons instead. So wherever it occurs, the cell will think this is the end, when it's really supposed to have gone for many more codons. And so however many amino acids it has added up to that point, it will stop there. And it'll just be partial protein rather than the entire polypeptide, which has very little chance of working, especially if it occurs toward the beginning, right? It will stop right away, think it's done, and that short peptide won't do anything for the cell. So that has a much more profound effect. All right, now to the second column. What's different about the second column is that these are not substitutions. It's not the case that something gets swapped for something else. Instead, we have either insertions or deletions. And therefore, either one of these, whether it's an insertion or a deletion, the gene is not the same length as the wild type anymore. It's either longer, in the case of an insertion mutation, because an insertion will put a nucleotide between two others, and therefore make it a nucleotide longer. Or it'll be shorter. A deletion removes one or more nucleotides, so the overall length will be shorter. Well, this causes a lot more widespread effects because it messes with what is called the frame of reference, the frame of reading. Remember we talked about the start codon, the AUG? It's important to have that start codon to show the cell where the first word is. A word is a good analogy here because, you know, it's not single letters that we really pay attention to, it's words that we pay attention to, right? Words have meanings, just like codons have meaning, not single nucleotides, but triplets of a nucleotides. And the meaning for a triplet is a specific amino acid. What's not perfect about the analogy, though, is that cells don't use words of different length like we do in language. You know, words can be a single letter or many letters. All the words that cells use in translation using genetic code are three-letter. But if you make up a sentence that is nothing but three-letter words, which is not all that hard to do, like the red owl, ate the cat. Let's see if I can get one that hasn't been left open overnight. You know, that sentence has meaning, right? Well, our reading frame in English is provided by the fact that we don't string all of our words together. We use spaces. So even if they aren't all three-letter words, we know where words begin and end because of those spaces. Well, cells don't use spaces between their codons. They just read three nucleotides at a time, consider that to be a word, from wherever it's told to start. Therefore, if you have an insertion mutation, that would be like sticking a letter in here somewhere. Like if you stuck a Q right in here, then it wouldn't be the red owl ate the cat anymore. It would be the RQE EDO, see that? WLA, and so on. That is what's called a frame shift. You see what I did, by the way? See where I'm getting these letters? When you stick this Q in here, everything else has to shift over one. So it's RQE and then DOL and then LAT, it's thinking are the separate words. That's what the new codons become. Well, a frame shift, which is what this is called, either right or left, depending on whether you take one out or put one in, affects all of the codons after the mutation, not just the codon that the mutation happens in. So you not only put the wrong amino acid down in the place where the mutation occurs, but every amino acid after that is going to be wrong. In other words, a frame shift is going to make some totally different protein. And the chance of that actually operating to do whatever the job the protein is supposed to do is effectively zero. So frame shift mutations have much more drastic effects and much harder to survive, in other words. But the same thing would happen with a deletion, right? If you take the, instead of putting one in, you take the D out here, then it becomes the REO, WLA, and so on. Substitutions don't do that because you don't change the overall length, and therefore once you set the reading frame with that start codon, all the words will be in the right place. By the way, when a frame shift does occur, it can still lead to similar effects. It can be, for instance, nonsense or missense. We still use the word nonsense and missense in the same way. Nonsense means you're putting the wrong amino acids down. Did I say missense? Missense means you're putting the wrong amino acids down. Nonsense means you're getting a premature stop codon. All right, 23. Well, at the beginning today, we looked at a polyribosome, which can occur in any kind of organism because a polyribosome conform after you already have a complete mRNA. But what we're looking at here is an even more efficient use of a gene that occurs only in prokaryotes. First, let's remember what the big difference is as far as gene expression is concerned between prokaryotic and eukaryotic organisms. Eukaryotic organisms have the two major processes within gene expression, transcription and translation, occur in different chambers, right? Different compartments. Prokaryotic cells don't have different compartments, so they don't have that extra complication. Therefore, in a prokaryotic cell, you can have this happen. This is blue thing is the DNA, as you see. This is one gene of a DNA. And just like in a polyribosome, as soon as a ribosome moves down far enough, you can hook another one on. Well, similarly, on a single gene, as soon as an RNA polymerase that's doing the transcription gets far enough along so it's out of the way, another RNA polymerase can start transcribing that same gene before it's done being transcribed by another RNA polymerase. So each of these RNA polymerases is transcribing the same gene, leading to multiple red copies of the same mRNA, but in different phases of completion. Okay? And each of those emerging mRNAs is not even waiting until transcription is done before ribosomes come along and clamp on, start translating it into many copies of the polypeptides. So you have multiple polyribosomes still hanging on to one gene in a prokaryotic cell, meaning that they can very quickly get a lot of copies of a needed polypeptide created quickly. And that's particularly important, by the way, for a single-celled organism. Anything that kills a cell is a dangerous thing if you're a single-celled organism, right? You lose your life. Doesn't have to be such an emergency situation in something that has 100 trillion cells like us. But this is possible. I mean, it would be nice to do this in eukaryotic cells as well, but it's possible only in prokaryotic cells simply because the mRNA does not have to be completed and then leave a nucleus before a polyribosome gets created. That's the difference. Well, that leaves just 24. This is the last slide of the unit. And it's really just a summary slide. So it's useful to, even though this is not new information, go through this again. This is a eukaryotic cell, obviously, right? You have a nucleus in this one. So gene expression starts with transcription. And transcription involves just one of the two strands of DNA in the gene, whatever the gene is. And RNA polymerase binds to that beginning of the gene. What is that place called? Where does it actually specifically bind RNA polymerase? No, this is not replication. This is transcription. Replication does the whole DNA and makes two copies, right? Here we're just looking at one gene. It's called the promoter. The promoter is the sequence at the very beginning of a gene. That is what the RNA polymerase recognizes. And also remember that typically transcription factors also have to be bound there first before RNA polymerase can come along. But anyway, it will read the sequence in the template strand, just one of the two strands being used in DNA. And using complementarity rules, add one RNA nucleotide at a time to create the mRNA transcript. And notice that it can, just as we've talked about, a new strand can grow only at the 3' end. So the red ribbon is the RNA transcript. This is a eukaryotic cell, so it's going to require some post-transcriptional modification. And that includes putting a 5' cap and a poly A tail on, but also splicing it, meaning use a spliceosome to take introns out, recognize where they are, cut them out, and hook all the exons together to form the mature mRNA, which then is able to leave the nucleus through a nuclear pore to go out into the cytoplasm and hook up with a small ribosomal subunit to start translation. That's where the polypeptide actually gets built. And that's what's happening right here. The small subunit binds, a small subunit binds to the mRNA. Then this large subunit comes along and you have a translation complex in place. One codon gets read at a time. That allows for the proper a kind of tRNA, and specifically an aminoacyl tRNA carrying just the right kind of amino acid, to come into the A slot. It shifts over. The transfer RNA that's in the middle is carrying however many amino acids have been added up to that point, but they then get transferred to the amino acid that's coming in on the aminoacyl tRNA, making the peptide one amino acid longer. And then that empties the former peptidyl tRNA, making it uncharged in the E slot, and it gets ejected. It's now uncharged, but it will meet up with its correct kind of aminoacyl tRNA synthetase enzyme to put the proper kind of amino acid back onto it. So if its codon gets called again, it will be ready to go into the A slot again. So just remember, you have a bunch of different kinds of tRNA, each carrying its own kind of amino acid, basically just waiting for the codon to come up. And that's an expensive process, so there's a bunch of GTP used in that as well. All right, any questions about the unit before I stop recording? All right, well, I wish we could start lab early, but we can't do that in case someone who's not here shows up. So I'll see you at the normal starting point.